Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, and also to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also on Radio Verulam in St Albans. Coming up this week...
Most of the people they saw were simple villagers, dressed in exactly the same clothes that are described in the Bible.
Yes, Anthea Page is down on the farm, Shute Farm in fact. She meets some pigs and chickens and talks about badger culling. Tony Gosling brings us another part of his conversation with Brother Clifford, the reformed alcoholic turned evangelical pastor. We get a physics lesson from the very smart Kays Langandaffy. He came in to talk to us about neutrinos. Dialect regular Michaela Dennis also tells us about the up-and-coming Mayfest Festival. As always, we have a Song of the Week with regular Tim Burrows. Malcolm Grieve gives us an instalment of Lady Hester Stanhope's diary, and we've got our What's On Guide and a Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. My name is John Peters Coleman. A few weeks ago, myself and Michaela caught up with a young gentleman called Kays Langandaffy, and we discussed the rising popularity of physics and why we should be interested in it. It's my pleasure to introduce Kays Langandaffy. Hello.
Hello.
Myself and Michaela are both here in front of the mic, so prove your presence.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Okay, we've invited Kays in to chat about neutrinos and such related things and similarities with Higgs boson particle, or no similarities, we don't know. But we are assured that Kays is all knowledgeable about these things, so you come to educate us. What is your interest in neutrinos?
Well, I studied physics at GCSE, and it's just really interesting. Subatomic particles really interest me, and there are lots of fascinating things that we still don't even know about them. And recently, in like September 2011, last year, we found out that neutrinos might be going faster than the speed of light, which would be groundbreaking physics, which pretty interesting.
Okay. Why is that groundbreaking physics for a complete beginner who has no idea what you're talking about?
Okay, Einstein said that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. And so if the neutrinos go faster than the speed of light, then Einstein's wrong, and... that's quite a big thing.
Okay. He's a pretty smart guy.
So you're doing your GCSEs at the moment?
Yep.
Okay, and do you know what you're going to be doing for your A-levels?
Yep, maths, physics, Russian and history.
Wow, okay, more than I did. Okay, fair enough. And where are you studying?
Bristol Grammar School.
Okay. Was this a surprise to your mum and dad? Are you going to be studying sort of so much, so many A-levels and such intense subjects, or is it...
Well, they kind of helped me choose my subject, so, and I'm really interested in pretty much everything, so I'm going to do, so it's going to be interesting.
Let's get down right to the meat of this now.
Yeah, okay.
Right, let's talk about what is a neutrino?
A neutrino is a really, really, really small thing, even smaller than an electron, and it's got no charge, so it's not, like, no attract or repel to things that... that have charge, like electrons or protons, which are also really small things, but neutrinos are really, really, really small. And also they travel quite fast, but we don't know how fast. We think they go faster than the speed of light, but we're doing lots of checks to see if they go really fast. We're doing a check in CERN, which is in Switzerland, near the Franco-Swiss border, in near Geneva, and we're sending neutrinos down about 731 kilometres to Gran Sasso, which is in the centre of Italy, and we're timing their kind of how fast they're going with a Common View GPS, which is basically we have a satellite up in space, and it sends a signal down to both Switzerland and Italy, both at the same time, so we can time it exactly to 1 to 10 nanoseconds.
Okay, so is a neutrino, I mean, is it still a physical thing?
Yes, it is a physical thing, but it's very small.
Right. How is this the kind of thing where they intuit the existence of such said item theoretically and then decide whether or not it is actually there by science? Or is it something that they've observed and said, what's that?
We can observe neutrinos, and we know they're definitely there. I think the Higgs boson is the famous thing that we don't know that's there. We think the Higgs boson is there. It's okay. Another very small thing, but we don't know.
So this is Professor Stephen Hawking's big alma mater. What is the Higgs boson for those who have no idea?
Okay, Higgs boson is a very, very small particle, which we think is there, but we don't know it's there. It may be called the God particle, because it's just kind of unknown.
Okay, so is it quite rare in science then, for example, in the case of this Higgs boson, to deduce the existence of something only theoretically and then you kind of have to look for it? Or is that how we discovered various other subatomic particles?
It depends. I think neutrino was a guess, and then we saw it later. But it depends. Just sometimes we see it, sometimes we just have to guess.
Okay.
How long are the experiments at CERN kind of likely to last? Because obviously there's huge investment in this really large building and huge scientific experiment, basically. And most people kind of probably only hear about it in terms of headlines that, you know, tomorrow we might all be in a big black hole. So
I think it will last quite a long time because there's always lots of things that we need to learn about science. I think the neutrino thing should only last up until the end of this year, maybe continuing to next year, because we just need to wait for data to come back. But there's loads of things that we need to find out, so it should last
for a while. What are the practical implications once we've... You know, what is it that we're going to actually learn, and what use is it going to be?
Well, it's quite important for most things. For example, with the neutrinos, if we find out that we can't go faster than the speed of light, then all of Einstein's like E equals mc squared may be wrong. And therefore, we might not... The energy we get from nuclear fusion, which is in the future would be a very good way of getting energy, may be wrong, and we need to rethink some of the stuff.
Okay, so explain how neutrinos affect this nuclear fusion. What is it?
Well, basically, because it's like the amount of energy we get from the nuclear fusion may be wrong, so we need to rethink how much energy we need to put to... Nuclear fusion is very different to neutrinos, because neutrinos are just... little thing. So nuclear fusion is a process where two hydrogen atoms combine together, which releases a lot of energy. The neutrinos might show that the energy produced may be different than what we expect if it goes faster than the speed of light.
Okay. I noticed that you say when they're doing studies, you don't say that they're doing studies. You say that you know, we're going to discover. Like, you're already in there. You're part of this. How long have you sort of? When did you really start to feel like, you know, this is like, you know, us, humanity, doing something and really taking an interest in it?
Well, I think it's always been like that, because we've always been everyone. It's kind of a collective thing, because it benefits everyone. Everyone, loads of countries are involved, and with the headlines, it kind of involves everyone.
Yeah. So as long as your living memory goes back, this is always something that you's...
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Speaking of kind of physics being more accessible and more kind of in popular culture, people like Professor Brian Cox, it's all becoming very kind of fashionable. And I definitely remember when physics wasn't fashionable. I mean, why do you think people are suddenly cottoning onto this is actually huge? This is really interesting and it affects every single thing we do every day.
Well, Einstein kind of helped because he's a really big character and everyone knows him. And if he might be wrong, then it kind of involves everyone. Also, I think Brian Cox is quite good. He has made physics quite accessible to all by making lots of programs that are quite easy for everyone to understand. And overall, they just...
But he doesn't shy away from, you know, he tries to explain it quite simply, but he doesn't shy away from, you know, these are still very big ideas and things that you need to kind of really sit down and think about. So I think that probably, do you think that has an effect on it? That people actually aren't being said, this is too hard for you, or, oh, it's really easy, don't worry about it. Yeah. People are actually talking about it in a realistic way.
Yeah, he's got the completely right balance. So you don't just get baffled by what he's saying, just don't understand any of it. But it's not too simple that just don't learn anything.
Okay, what do you want to do, you know, with your life, your career? I mean, do you want to be a physicist?
I have no idea. Route's always open, and I would like to, but I don't know if I'm well.
I'd suggest going down to CERN and hurrying it all up a bit.
Yeah, it should take quite a while. I think they're going to get results by the end of May.
Okay, how do you sort of find out all of this stuff? I mean, do you just check out information online? Do you subscribe to magazines or...?
Well, I don't really subscribe to magazines, but I know A New Scientist is very good. But yeah, I find out on the internet or books or things.
Are you kind of unusual among your peer group, or just, you know, everyone is interested in science to this level?
Well, quite a lot of my friends, we're kind of nerds, so thank you. But quite a lot of my friends are interested in science, and I think it's getting quite popular.
What do you, what do you dream about in terms of, you know, what you dream yourself as being like, you know, 10, 20 years from now? Mega physicist, really important?
Greater than Einstein would be satisfactory, but I don't really mind.
I think we should leave it there.
We should leave it there. Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you.
Now spring has arrived, so what better time is there to leave the town and head out to the countryside? But is it really all that idyllic in these real-life Ambridges out there in the countryside? Our reporter Anthea Page goes to Devon to find out.
Hampton Farm.
Where is it?
Shoot.
Well, I'm down on the farm and there's two very unusual looking pigs. What are they?
They're Cooney Coonies.
They're Alison's pigs. She's just bought them. Mm-hmm. Where do they come from?
Branscombe, near Seaton.
Where in the world do they come from?
I think it's New Zealand.
Can you describe them?
They're smaller than your normal pig and they've got two beriberis just under their chin.
What's a beriberi?
Well, I don't think it does actually anything.
They don't look like pigs, do they?
No.
Very, very strange. They're a kind of sandy colour with black spots.
Yeah.
They make this funny noise.
This one's much...
Oh. Well, they've got like two little growths under their chin. And they've got very little tails, haven't they?
Yeah.
Why did you buy these pigs? What's the idea behind it?
Hopefully in a couple of years I'll be able to breed from them. You can't eat them until they're sort of like about 2 years old, so I'll breed from them first. So.
Would they make good sausages?
Apparently so, yeah. Very tasty.
What kind of taste? Is it different to normal ones?
I've not actually tried them myself, but the lady I got them off said it's very nice. Yeah, so hopefully.
So how old are these now?
They're about 11 weeks old.
And how long will it take before they get to adult?
About 2-3 years.
Is it expensive to feed them?
No, because they mainly eat grass or vegetable scraps. I've got a few nuts as well that I give them.
How easy is it to find these pigs in this country?
You can go on to a Cooney Cooney Society website and it shows you all the breeders and everything, so if you've got one near you, it's even better.
They all look this colour, this kind of sandy colour with black spots, or do you get a variation?
You can get cream and black ones. I mean, you can get just plain ginger ones, black ones. But it's mainly sort of that colour.
How big will they grow? Because they're very small. You wouldn't get much sausage meat out of those.
They grow to about knee height.
Will they grow tusks, the males?
No. These ones here have got quite sharp teeth, so you wouldn't want to put your fingers in. But they're very soft.
Would these be wild in New Zealand then?
Yeah, I suppose they'd be roaming free, yeah. For sure.
What have you called them?
Jessie and Honey.
I'll bet that one's Honey because it looks more yellower.
Oh, no, I was going to call this one Honey. Jessie.
This is the sound of a pig being picked up. He's not happy. Don't have a pig as a pet. Alison, these were in the chicken pen. What are these chickens?
These are golden silkies. They're bantams, so they only lay the smaller egg.
They haven't got any coxcomb on the top of their head?
No, rather than having feathers, it's mainly fluff. It's very fine. They've got like a blackberry thing on the top of their heads, like for a comb.
It's like a pom-pom, isn't it? Yeah. It's very pretty.
Yeah, they've got little feathers on their feet. Eggs for a week.
Is it? Is that true?
No.
Do they come from?
I think they're sort of like from China originally.
Are they all that lovely brown, soft brown colour then?
You can get darker ones. I did have some black ones once, but I sold those on to a local farmer.
So they only lay small eggs, yeah?
Yeah, there might be.
I'm going to look in the hatch now and see if there's any in there.
No, it's empty. Doing. No, they're only sort of about that. They're about half the size of a normal egg.
Nice to eat?
Yeah, yeah, they're very yellow, whereas your short ones are paler.
I'm here in Devon and I'm here with a farmer and we're going to talk about the recent controversy over badger culling. Hello.
Hello. Yes, badger culling.
What is the main problem for the farmers with the badgers?
If you're heavily stocked and what have you, and you've got to keep these animals because you can't sell them, we run out of forage and they don't mind, you know, they don't want to kill badgers, but they don't mind killing thousands of cows.
What's the link between TB and badgers? Is there a very strong link in your experience?
Yes, it's definitely the badgers that are spreading it around. Got all these scientists and what have you, you'll get them arguing between themselves, you know, what's right and what's wrong. The veterinary profession have come out and said that it is definitely badgers.
Have you got badgers on your land?
We have.
How many?
I don't honestly know, but we got far more than we used to have. They're digging sets, places we've never had badgers before.
They don't have any predators, do they?
No, it's like it was given out on television last week. You know, the biggest predator is the car. And they say there's a lot more being killed with the cars. That's because the population is that much bigger.
If the government decides the cull's necessary, how do they go about it? Do they come on the farms and shoot them?
I think it'll be left up to the individual farmer. I'm not sure on how they will act, but I think the farmer will have a licence to be, you know, cull some badgers.
To shoot them?
Yes.
Besides digging up the land, what other problems do badgers bring? What do they feed on?
Worms. The dung pats and that, they'll scratch them out. It's that sort of forage that they're after.
How long would it take for them to establish a really big set, do you reckon?
It'd run for about 5 years, I would imagine. And the other feed sources are maize and that. They love pulling down maize for the cob.
Oh, so they destroyed the crops?
Yes, even with cornfields and that. You know, as soon as the grain starts to get ripe, they'll be pulling down the corn.
So could they devastate a whole field or not?
They generally stick to an outside of a field, about 10 metres in, and they'll go around the field like that.
So do other farmers feel the same about the badgers as you do?
You'll always find one that'll have an argument the other way, but I think you'll find the very vast majority of farmers will say the same.
So if they cull the badgers for 1 year, say, would that solve the problem or not?
It would help to solve the problem.
Do you think there's too much interference from people in the universities and towns on this matter, that there's not enough consultation with country people?
Well, if badgers were to move into the towns like the foxes have and what have you, I think they'd probably have a different view. They're living in these cities and what have you. They talk all these stories and that. Do they really know what's going on in the countryside?
That was Dialect's reporter Anthea Page down on Shute Farm in Devon. I'm joined now by Michaela Dennis in the studio, who wants to let us know about the Mayfest programme of events that is coming up in May.
Hello, John.
Good to see you in the studio.
Oh, thanks. I'm here quite a lot usually, But in this particular occasion, I'd like to talk about Mayfest, which is a festival of contemporary, like modern theatre and dance, which Bristol puts on throughout the month of May and now early June. So perhaps it should be May June Fest, but they thought that was a bit too long, so they stopped that.
Right.
And it's just Mayfest. And the reason why I want to talk about it is because there's a couple of reasons. It's really good and it's kind of very different from your normal kind of check-offs and stage stuff that you'd usually get in the theatre. It's quite challenging. There's a lot of improv and dance, which I think is pretty cool. But also there's lots of volunteering opportunities for local people in Bristol. I know that's something that we talk about a lot on Dialect. So I just thought it'd be a cool thing to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. So tell us a little bit more about where people can look all of this stuff up.
So they've got a website. So it's mayfestbristol.co.uk. And they've just released the programme of events. And basically, at the minute, there's probably about 30 to 35 kind of different shows. And I've kind of picked out a couple, which I think kind of show the variety of what they do. But on the whole, it's plays and dance, but also kind of improv and also stuff in site-specific venues. So there's things down the Arnolfini, Bristol Old Vic, you know, the normal theatres and yep. performance spaces that we've got. But there's a lot of site-specific stuff, things that are being renovated and used just for the productions, and also pop-up things which you don't necessarily know too much about before, a few days before the actual production.
So some of these are stuff you pay for, some of it's free.
Yeah, so that's the other thing. It's kind of quite inclusive. So your average show is probably between £6 and £10, but there's also some stuff which is pay what you can. And hopefully it's meant to be more inclusive than kind of, as I say, kind of normal, theatre set, I suppose. So that's another reason why I think it should be kind of pushed quite heavily.
Okay.
Shall I take you for a couple of the things that I think are quite cool?
Please do, yeah.
So we've got the first thing I spotted was something called Made Up by Molly Naylor and Byron Vincent. And this is running from the 17th of May on through to the beginning of June. And basically, they've asked stories from people in the local community, which they're going to be taking on and doing an improv with in different sites all over the city throughout the period I've just said. And a lot of it is going to be, some of it will be in people's homes, some of it will be in the theatre itself, some of it will be kind of outside. So it's completely dependable, changes every single day. There'll be information at the Bristol Old Vic on what is happening with Made Up on the individual day you want to go and see it. That's a pay what you can. And as I say, it's kind of crowdsourced, I suppose, from Bristol people. So people who want to have kind of individual things they want to say to specific people, or kind of experiences and stories that have happened to them over the years or recently, which they think make kind of good fodder, I suppose, for creative improv. So there is going to be a big final performance at the end, I think around the 10th of June, but it's kind of one of those things where it's just organic and they're just going to see where it takes them. So that was quite an interesting thing,
yeah.
Which I thought would be cool. And so that's a pay what you can type one, so it's open to everybody. Another couple of things, there's a really amazing thing they put on a couple of years ago was Electric Hotel. So it was the big flagship performance that they had, and it was this big prefab down by the harbour side of like the innards of like this hotel. So it's three stories high, it's absolutely huge, and it's a dance piece basically by someone called Frauke Reckart. Yeah, Google Electric Hotel, it's amazing. It's possibly the coolest thing I've ever seen, and they've got a new thing that they're doing at Mayfest this year called Episode. Their description of it makes it sound really arty, and I think that this is the thing that people get put off a lot by with something like Mayfest.
Right,
you go to the Arnolfini and you've got no idea what's going on.
Yeah,
that's kind of what this description sounds like. But Episode draws upon the intense and intimate encounters of six individuals unleashing a colourful sequence of events that capture anarchically riotous relationships and exquisitely private revelations. That's nice, but if you go, you'll actually see what that means. So
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it's massively physical dance theatre, and the international dances they had for Electric Hotel were just phenomenal. So give it a go, I suppose, is what
If we put Mayfest in the web and look all of this stuff up, that's a good place to start.
Yes, it is. And the other thing I wanted to briefly say about it is the whole volunteering aspect of it. So if you go onto bristoleventvolunteers.co.uk, at the minute they're kind of helping Mayfest get together loads of volunteers all over the city, and they're asking for like specific roles. So there's lots of production, there's stewarding, there's helping out in the cafes. There's a pop-up cafe called the Parlour Cafe, which is opposite College Green, so at the bottom of Park Street. So that's on throughout the Mayfest period. And also helping out, they've got a bar that they open called the Blind Tiger, which is at the Bristol Old Vic as well. So there's like loads of different ways to get involved, and if you get involved you can see shows for free, you can just generally hang out with people at Mayfest, which are kind of creative, cool people. So if you go on to Bristol Event Volunteers.co.uk, they've got a Twitter feed as well at Bristol EV. So take a look at that, and there's like plenty of opportunities for people to get involved. So I think what I'm trying to say is Google Mayfest. It will be exciting and cool.
Michaela Dennis, thank you very much.
Yay.
Reformed alcoholic and travelling evangelist Brother Clifford visited Bristol recently to tell homeless people about his journey from death's door to travelling around Europe, talking about his experiences and answering the difficult questions about his faith. Now, Tony Gosling caught up with him in his van as he was passing Bristol on his way to Denmark to start yet another year of touring churches and house groups all over Europe. Tony asked him whether he agreed that many evangelists were really money-making con men, cashing in on the vulnerable in society.
Yes, okay, out there are con merchants. There are people do it for their own ends. I remember one evangelist saying, "We need all your money because my wife and I require a plane each so we can go and talk to people." And I say, "Well, why don't you just go on EasyJet and talk to the person sat next to you?" I'm not into doing it for money. If I did, I wouldn't be doing this job. But it's not a job, it's a vocation. I should have retired 2 years ago. But no way, I don't even get a pension. I live totally in faith with the one I love the most in the world. You cannot describe the love you have for Jesus when you get to know him properly. I can depend on him. I can't depend on his people all the time. Most of them, well, we don't know why they seem to talk about him. And I know the right kind of people and the wrong kind of people. But I know that no matter what happens, I can trust my Jesus.
Yeah, but I mean, surely, I mean, we've got the Church of England, we've got all these churches everywhere. Why do we need people like you as well?
You don't need people like me as well. You don't need the Church of England or the Catholic Church or the Lutheran Church. You need Jesus. Wherever he is the church. It is not a building. He said, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name, I will be in the midst of them." That's good enough. I speak sometime on television, last recorded from Iceland. That went out to 96 countries, 100 million people listening to me. And yet I'm here talking to one man in my little van, or sometime it's two or three at a prayer meeting. Quantities don't matter. It's what you have to say that matters. Here in Bristol, I've been coming here for many years now. Actually, this is the first place I ever came to. When I was dying, and the Lord sent me out to sing on the streets, the first place I started was Bristol. It's amazing. And I still meet some of the people who came to that first prayer meeting that I was invited to and spoke for the first time. Bristol, I never did anything for a long time, and then this year it seems to have taken off. They invite me to come and speak at soup meetings, breakfast meetings, prayer meetings, home meetings, healing meetings. I will speak anywhere about Jesus. All my message really is Jesus is enough for you, and you must know him. You must say, "Jesus, come into my heart, forgive my sins, I want to follow you." And then keep your promise. Follow this Jesus. He died for you. He died for each person out there. He died for the one person that's listening at this moment. Can't you live for him?
The problem is, of course, that it can be very difficult following someone like Jesus. In a way, he was a bit of a sort of Jewish revolutionary, and that's not necessarily the easy way, is it?
Well, let's be Bristol revolutionaries, shall we? Let's follow this Jesus, because all he preaches is love. And if you can't live love, what can you live? It's either love or hate. It's either follow him or follow your own desires. And most people that listen to this know that your own desires get you into a lot of trouble. The only trouble you can get into if you follow Jesus is, well, I can't think of any, can you? He's just wonderful. He's the one that always has the perfect answer, the perfect solution. No matter what you do on earth, do it well, but do it unto others as you would have it done unto you. Don't live in hate. Don't live in the past. Live with Jesus. Live with forgiveness. Because if you can't forgive someone, how can he forgive you? I found some people very difficult to forgive when I started this work. People who'd hurt me. People who'd abused me. But once I got round that and I was able to say, yes, you are forgiven. You are forgiven. I can live now. It was such a load off my chest. Do you know, many people hate others. They hold grudges against them. And they don't realise the person they hold the grudge against isn't even aware of it. They've just said something untoward in a moment. And you've taken offence. Forget it. Get on with living. But live not only for yourself. Live so that people will remember you one day for what you are. Who wants to be known as a miser, a thief, a liar, when you can be remembered with love? All I want people to remember me by when the day comes I've gone is, he followed Jesus. He followed Jesus.
We've obviously got the Bible, but I mean, day to day, how do you communicate with Jesus? I mean, he died 2,000 years ago. He's not the easiest guy to communicate with.
It is faith. It is total faith. Faith that he is there. Faith that he lived and died. They cannot dispute that he lived and died. He's the only one that ever rose from the dead. He's the only one that you can turn round to and say, Jesus, you are real. I know he's real. The feeling I get inside of me sometimes, it has to be real. Otherwise, what have I got to live for? What have you got to live for? People come and they talk about the tribulation, they talk about the end times. I'm not interested. I'm only interested in one thing, and that's today. What did he say to the thief on the cross? Today you shall be with me in paradise. And he was. I wonder what day I'll be going. I'm ready. What about you?
For a lot of people, the idea of actually having any kind of real relationship with Jesus is completely impossible because, like I say, 2,000 years ago, I mean, obviously Christians believe that he's still alive, but, you know, this is a guy that died at least once anyway, a long time ago.
Yes. Many people come across this. But then, it's the same when you talk about evolution, you talk about the creation of the world. People say it started with a big bang somewhere in space. What a load of rubbish. I've never heard anything like it. If there was a big bang, it had to start with at least two constituent parts. It had to start with air and something that would cause the explosion. If there was nothing there, how could it have caused an explosion? It would just have been a vacuum forever. I don't know where God came from. I'm not interested where God came from. I don't know where Jesus came from. I'm not interested where he came from. The only thing I know is he's real. If he wasn't real, I would not be here now. Cirrhosis of the liver? He took it away. The doctors say, I was dying. They have all the evidence there that this man could not live. And he's not there anymore. Brain damage? I have no memory. I couldn't remember things I did 2 minutes earlier. Jesus touched him, my memory came back. Cancer. I had cancer of the tonsils. One of the most horrendous cancers you can have. Then it moved into my neck. Lymph nodes. The doctor said those are the two cancers that are actually the most destructive and there is no cure for them. That was 12 years ago, and there's no sign of it anymore. The Lord has healed me. No. I don't care what people say or think. I know that Jesus is real. And you know, I'm only interested in what I believe. You can believe what you like. But I know that in the end, my belief is true. If you believe something different, okay. But you try and convince Jesus when you meet him at the other side. Because Jesus will say, If you did not follow me, you cannot come in. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father, to God, except through him.
Brother Clifford there, reformed alcoholic and travelling evangelist in his van, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling, and you can find him online, www.brotherclifford.com. Of course, you missed it last week, but we have another episode of The Diaries of the Extraordinary Lady Hester Stanhope, a socialite and adventurer. And it's read, as ever, by Malcolm Grieve.
The Diary of Lady Hester Stanhope. Their progress up the coast of Palestine was quiet. There was time to observe in detail their surroundings and the few people they came across. There were no bandits such as Abu Ghosh, since the strip of flat land between the coast and the mountains did not afford sufficient protection. Most of the people they saw were simple villagers, dressed in exactly the same clothes that are described in the Bible. "The dress of the men was a cotton shirt," Marion reported, "buckled round the waist with a leathern belt, over which they threw a long woollen cloak called an abar, or meshlar, without sleeves. The women dressed in the same way, with the addition of a veil of coarse white cotton." Marion loved to see the women carry water from the wells, and greatly admired their posture, although he realised the work was very toilsome. His doctor's eye noted rather pedantically that, far from giving a curve to the spine, depressing the neck, or in any wise shortening the growth of the body, the resistance of the muscles seems to increase in proportion to the pressure, and much elasticity of action is the result. When dressed in their best clothes, the women wore yellow slippers, silver bracelets around their wrists and ankles, silver relic cases on a chain round their necks, and, most becomingly, silver rims of mail or coins, which take in the oval of the face from the temples to the chin, and have a very pretty effect. The doctor was becoming quite a connoisseur of women. As they approached Acre, the slip of land between sea and mountain narrowed until they felt as if they were travelling along a garden path. They pitched their tents within the ruined walls of the Venetian castle Pellegrino, and the next day saw the great Bay of Acre open in front of them. Acre was a fortified ancient town and one of the major trading ports of the East. Silks, perfumes and porcelain from China had all been part of the regular trade until the discovery of the new sea routes made the old overland trading roads redundant. The Austrian consul in Acre was a man called Mr. Catafago, and he had invited Lady Hester to stay in his house, an offer she gladly accepted. He sent his son and nephew to meet her on the road, and they escorted the party through the single city gate and narrow cobbled streets to his home. Mr. Catafago and his family made Lady Hester and her party extremely welcome. Marion actually called his hospitality unremitting. But Acre was not a happy town. The previous pasha was called El Jezar, and he had been a man of ferocious cruelty. His nickname was the Butcher, and his favourite form of control and punishment was mutilation. On every street, men and women with no eyes, ears or noses could be seen. Amputation of sexual organs was also popular with him, and once, in a fit of jealous rage, he had had all the ladies of his harem sewn into sacks and thrown into the sea. Lady Hester was sickened by what she heard and saw, but allowed herself to be shown around the town. She inspected the battlements that had held so successfully against Bonaparte, and saw the famous mosque that had been constructed from granite, porphyry and marble, ransacked from the ruins of Caesarea and Ascalon. She was not, however, tempted to stay for too long in the town. Mr. Catafago had a summer house at Nazareth, and the party decided to make a short trip there out of curiosity. Whilst they were there, they were amazed to be addressed in English by what had seemed to be a perfectly ordinary Bedouin. Although the man was dressed poorly in a coarse cotton shirt, he had blue eyes and a broad Germanic face. It was the famous traveller Burkhardt, who was travelling incognito as a poor peasant. He was delighted to meet some fellow Europeans, and stayed for 2 or 3 days before continuing his travels. Strangely enough, Lady Hester took a dislike to him, although she never said why. Maybe the fact that the two of them had chosen such diametrically opposite ways of travelling indicated something very different in their personalities. In a letter to Crawford Bruce in September of that year, she wrote, "To go to Palmyra or anywhere else like a thief, I do not like, to skulk about, fearing to meet this and that tribe of Bedouins. I go as a friend of them all." Burkhardt later wrote warmly to Michael, offering his services to Lady Hester if required, and furnishing her with some amazingly detailed information about the breeds of Arab horses that she had evidently requested. There were, undoubtedly, benefits to be gained from both ways of travel. It was now July, and the weather was becoming unbearably hot. On the 24th of May, Michael had received a letter from his father complaining about how much money he was drawing. This had been a great worry to both Michael and Hester, and they had both written to Crawford, trying to explain why so much expense was necessary. After having lost everything in the shipwreck at Rhodes, they had been obliged to reprovision, and that had cost a lot. They had spent over £3,000 since December, and Michael's allowance for the year was only £2,500. Michael felt humiliated. "If you're not satisfied," he wrote to his father, "and should imagine that I'm guilty of any wanton extravagance, I shall feel most deeply mortified, as I would rather remain on the bleakest mountain of Scotland and feed upon bread and water than that it should for a moment be supposed that I was capable of abusing your generosity." Hester adopted a more pragmatic approach. When she had first met Michael, he had been extremely careless with money, leaving his money in the hand of his servant and never inquiring the price of anything and paying a bill without looking at it. She had changed all that and had insisted that meticulous records be kept. The ledgers from Constantinople had all been lost in the shipwreck, but all their expenses from Alexandria on were available. She pointed out to Crawford that although Michael had many natural attributes, information must be acquired, and it was no good hiring cheap guides or dragomen, since they knew nothing and could therefore impart no worthwhile local knowledge. The giving of lavish presents to all they met was another part of the drain on Crawford's pocket, but this has always been the custom in Eastern countries and is even mentioned in the Bible. In the first book of Samuel, 10:27, it says, "And they despised him and brought him no presents." It was taken as an insult to make a visit without bringing a gift, and of course the greater the personage, the more magnificent the present had to be. Lesser people such as court officials and superior servants also expected their backsheesh, and would often make life very awkward if it was not forthcoming. Lady Hester evidently felt that nothing should be spared in the advance of Michael's education, but told Crawford, "If I have mistaken your views, I am sorry for it, and expense shall cease." She had, of course, her own allowance of £1,200 a year, and had been living quite happily within her means before she met Michael. So perhaps the accusations that were later levelled at her of being profligate with Crawford's money were unfair.
That was all about Lady Hester, Queen of the Desert, and it was read as ever by Malcolm Grieve. Thank you very much. Time for a song from Tim Burrows. We're going to choose a song that we had as a play-out track on the end of the show last week, which we didn't all hear properly. So we're going to hear that again properly now, and here is Kayla from last week to introduce it again.
We're joined once again by Tim Burrows. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Thanks for coming. And I believe you have a song for us today.
I've got a composition, so it's a tune. It's called As the Memories Fade.
Great. Thank you. Thanks very much, Tim. That was lovely. It was quite sad, I thought.
Yes, it's about a relationship breakdown, and I'm composing some pieces around those sort of, you know, some happy but some sad.
Are they going to be Spanish inspired as well?
That's in a minor key. It's in a minor tuning, so that's why that's got that sort of feel. But some are more upbeat, and I'm hoping to call the CD "The High Vaulted Ceiling." So I'm kind of working around that.
Well, we look forward to it. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Time for the What's On Guide, courtesy of Jeff Sparks via Addy. Hello.
Hello, dear. Hello. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 26th April, Allswig Tentacles will be performing with support at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On Friday, 27th April, the tribute to the Doors, Slamming the Doors, will be performing with support from Snatch It Back and Bills Ills at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Deavish. They are a traditional Irish music group from County Sligo in Ireland. Formed in 1989 and to date have released 8 studio albums, a live album and a compilation album. This is from the album Playing With Fire, which was released in 1995 and is the last track, Last Night's Fun. was Steve-ish with the Last Night's Fun from the album Playing With Fire. For more information, you can check out www.dfish.ie or type in Dfish in your search engine. Into Saturday, 28th April, Geno Washington will be performing with support from Yo-Yo Blues at the Thunderbolt in Barford, Bristol. Tickets are £13 in advance. Doors open at 7pm. Finally, on 28th April, James Taylor Quartet will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7pm. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Adieu. Thank you very much. Well, that's all from Dialogue this week. Thank you very much to our studio guests. We had Kays Langandaffy and Michaela Dennis. Our features were from Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Tim Burrows treated us to a song. We had an episode of Lady Hester Stanhope's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve, and Jess Marks wrote this week's What's On Guide, which was read by Addy. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. If you'd like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. Finally, please remember, we are all volunteers. We are all looking for new contributors all the time. If you're interested, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on volunteerbristol.org.uk, or you can give them a call on 0117 989 7733. Also, if you're interested in volunteering for Mayfest, as Michaela mentioned earlier, please contact Bev. That's Bristol Events Volunteers, that stands for. At bristoleventvolunteers.co.uk, or they tweet at Bristol EV. My name is John Peters Common. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
I am not an atomic playboy.